to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, September 24th. I'm your reader, Mary Neff. We'll take a brief look at the weather, and if you notice that it seems a bit warmer, you are right. Today's high of 76 will be about 20 degrees higher than yesterday. It is going to be 76 for the high, low of 54, a little bit breezy, winds 10 to 20 miles an hour. Tomorrow, much breezier, 20 to 30 mile an hour winds with a high of 71, and on Monday, high of 68, and again, those winds 20 to 30. All 3 days, though, are supposed to be mainly sunny. The normal high and low for this time of year is around 72, and for the high, 49 for the low. But in 1984, there was a record high of 92 and a record low in 2012 of 28 degrees. There will be 12 hours and 4 minutes of daylight today, so I hope you are able to enjoy it in some way. There are 3 stories on the Gazette's front page. We will start with what appears to be the lead story based on the size of the font and so forth. It is from Aaron Jordan, and it's titled Book Challenges: Iowa Lawmakers Consider Criminal Charges for Librarians and Teachers Over Controversial Books. Parents in 3 corridor school districts have filed book challenges in the last year with complaints about a movie, books in verse, and graphic novels, including a Caldecott Medal-winning book, A Clear Creek, A Man Apparent Called Complete and Utter Garbage. This is Banned Books Week, celebrated since 1982 to highlight the value of free and open access to information. There's more fanfare than usual, in part to counter increasing political pressure to remove books, especially about race and LGBTQ issues, said Betsy Gomez, Banned Books Week national coordinator. She said in an interview with the Gazette, "What we're forgetting is kids are pretty smart. We are underestimating their ability to understand some material. There are people who are motivated to remove entire topics from libraries." Iowa lawmakers this year considered bills that would have allowed parents to sue schools over obscene books and would have levied criminal charges against librarians and teachers. Book challenges in the Cedar Rapids, Lynn Mar, and Clear Creek Amana school districts illustrate new ways parents are seeking to influence curriculum and shield students from materials they find objectionable. The Watchmen comics, written by Alan Moore and illustrated by Dave Gibbons, depict superheroes in 1985 facing ethical dilemmas, personal issues, and failings. The graphic novel won the 1988 Hugo Award for the Best Science Fiction or Fantasy Works and was included in Time Magazine's 2005 list of the 100 Best English Language Novels since 1923. Cedar Rapids Kennedy High School students taking the English class Perspectives in Literature and Composition have been reading Watchmen since at least 2013, according to The Torch, the school newspaper. But this year, a parent or parents challenged use of Watchmen, both as a book and movie, according to minutes from a February 7th meeting of the Cedar Rapids Community School District's Instructional Materials Reconsideration Committee. The minutes state the complainant objected to the entire film, including scenes of sex and nudity, violence, gore, profanity, alcohol, drugs, and smoking. The committee discussed how Watchmen fit with the English curriculum and Iowa Core Language Arts standards, which include making strategic use of digital and visual media and determining an author's/creator's point of view. The group decided to let a 38-minute movie clip remain with a new parental permission slip that lets families opt in to the viewing. Students will not be encouraged to watch the remainder of the film, the minutes state. Kennedy teachers may continue to have students read Watchmen, but the school will add potentially controversial to the class description, the March 2nd minutes state. Lynn Mar Community School District charged the Gazette $162 to provide 140 pages of records, about 70 of which dealt with one book challenge last spring. Parent Mindy Walderbach wrote in an April 4th email to the Lynn Mar School Board, "On Friday, I had 2 books brought into my home from the Lynn Mar High School Library. The books are titled Tricks and Traffic. I've attached images of the book for your review." Tricks and Traffic are companion novels in verse by Ellen Hopkins that portray 5 teens victimized by sex trafficking who try to find a way to a new life, according to Goodreads, which is a website that offers reviews of books. Walderbach asked, why are books discussing drugging people and discussion of how wonderful drugs are, allowing sick inside our buildings? Why are books discussing prostitution allowed inside our buildings? Do we have Bibles at LMHS and all of our buildings for students to check out? She asked the board about the process to request books be removed from school libraries. Walderbach's letter caused the district to form a reconsideration committee for the first time, emails show. Superintendent Shannon Bisgard wrote to Linmar High School librarian Brian Johnson on April 18th, saying, as you know, we've had a parent file a request for reconsideration in regards to a couple of library books. Per board policy, we need to activate a reconsideration committee to review these materials and make a determination on this request. Would you be willing to serve as the teacher librarian that serves on this committee? Bisgard told Walderbach in a July 5th email, the committee decided to keep the books in the high school library. Bisgard included among the six reasons for his decision, it is important to provide a range of literary topics in school libraries and, when read in their entirety, both books in question provide the reader with cautionary tales of drugs, human trafficking, and the dangers of various lifestyle choices. He also highlighted the difference between books used as instructional materials and those available for free reading in the library. The Gazette left two voicemails for Walderbach seeking comment for this story, but did not hear back. A Clear Creek Amana parent in February challenged a graphic novel that refers to sex, teen pregnancy, and alcohol use, as well as swearing, and mentions a miscarriage by the main character's mother. This book, This One Summer, by Jillian Tamaki and Mariko Tamaki, has won numerous awards, including the 2015 Caldecott Medal, which recognizes the most distinguished American picture book for children. It also was on the American Library Association's list of 10 most challenged books in 2016 and 2018. The novel features two tween girls, Rose and Wendy, during a summer at the beach as they observe snippets of the lives of older teens and adults and try to make sense of what is happening around them. Parent Kim Steins wrote CCA middle school principal Brad Fox on February 14th, saying, I am writing to express my disgust with a choice of reading material that my daughter brought home from the middle school library. The book she brought home is complete and utter garbage. Who does the ordering of the books and deems what is suitable for middle schoolers? I would hope there are more than one set of eyes making these decisions, and if so, they had poor taste in this one. Fox emailed the interim superintendent Joseph Brown and Matt Lehman, associate superintendent / secondary curriculum director, on February 14th. How would you like me to proceed with this? If what she sent is in our library, I must say I don't support it either. Look at the pages she shared with me, Fox wrote in an email. It does not appear the administrators wrote back until late August. An email from the Gazette to Steins on Wednesday has gone unanswered. Lori Robertson, Director of Finance and School Board Secretary, asked Fox in an email August 24th, do you have any follow-up from the meeting with the parent? Was there any action taken to remove the book? Fox responded, no, I still have the book in my office, I think. The kid had it in her possession and then gave it to me. The graphic novel has been missing from the library's collection since at least April, said Chris Peterson, director of the Springmeyer Community Library, a public library in Tiffin that also serves the middle school library. Peterson told the Gazette, as far as I know, that's been the only book challenge we've had in my 15 years here. This One Summer was donated to the library rather than purchased by the school or city, Peterson said. Amazon.com rates the book appropriate for ages 11 and up, and library staff had labeled it as realistic fiction, she added. She said, you know, I think Caldecott Honors books are rated pretty well. Life's tough, and it's a realistic graphic novel. District spokeswoman Lori Heyman said new superintendent Corey Seymour was not aware of the book challenge that happened before he started, and the district will need to further investigate the book's whereabouts. Gomez, the banned Books Week coordinator, said graphic novels face more book challenges because parents do a, quote, flip test and find one image that offends them without reading the whole book. Graphic novels get challenged for the same reasons as prose, but the images make them more vulnerable, she said in an interview Thursday, continuing, we see something offensive and we tend to have a strong reaction to it. Some people think graphic novels are not as valuable as literature, despite research that comics engage multiple parts of the brain to help with understanding of complicated or sophisticated subjects. The Gazette also filed requests with the Iowa City and Community School Districts for documents related to book challenges. Both districts reported they have not had any challenges since January 1, 2020. Ben Welsh, a Swisher native and a reporter at Stanford's Big Local News, contributed to this report. And we shift to the front page to something very different. Lynn Seeks Feedback on Highway 100 Trail Bridge, written by Gage Miskimen, Dateline Cedar Rapids. Lynn County Conservation is looking for feedback on a trail bridge over the Cedar River. The Highway 100 trail is being planned to extend from 42nd Street Northeast near Xavier High School in Cedar Rapids through the Rock Island Botanical Preserve to the Cedar River. It would follow the Highway 100 right-of-way, connecting Northeast Cedar Rapids to Northwest Cedar Rapids and also connecting to the Cedar Rapids Trail System. That route requires a pedestrian-slash-biking bridge over the Cedar River, and conservation officials are considering using the abandoned Milwaukee Road Bridge as a base. They're now asking the public what they think of the idea. The Highway 100 Trail survey is linked on Lynn County Conservation's website and is open until 5 p.m. on October 14th. Ryan Schlater, Lynn Conservation Community Outreach Specialist, said, "We're at the point right now to study and see what we can do. There are some existing piers and abutments from the railroad, and we are asking if we can repurpose them." End quote. The Corridor Metropolitan Planning Organization awarded Lynn County Conservation money to study possibilities for the old railroad bridge. Part of that study includes asking the public what kind of bridge they'd like to see. Schlater asked, "Should we start with a new bridge? It will be a substantial effort with partners, but we want to keep the momentum moving, but it will take some time. What's the best use of the remaining bridge piers? What should a trail bridge look like? What features should be included with the trail itself?" Schlater said the new trail will provide a connection with a large population base around Xavier High School and eventually extend to Morgan Creek Park. From there, the Highway 100 Trail will connect to the Cherokee Trail and continue to Cherry Hill Park and into Cedar Rapids. Schlater said, "The Highway 100 Trail is now in the engineering and planning stages and has been talked about for a decade. We want something functional, and we have different options for design. There will be big decisions coming up." End quote. No timeline or cost estimates have been made yet, though Schlater expects the project will cost several million dollars. He said, "We have a few years before we can get a bridge established, but the Conservation Board is interested in sooner rather than later if we can get funding in place. That's where the survey is a player. Depending on funding and what the public wants, we will then have options." The Conservation Board also sees the Highway 100 Trail having potential to create an outdoor recreation destination in Lynn County, similar to the High Trestle Trail Bridge near the Des Moines metro area. And finally, Schlater said, "There are some great pedestrian bridges that are a big destination and tourist attraction, and Lynn County is becoming an outdoor recreation destination. The community wants to keep that enthusiasm going now." Finally, from the front page, this is from Tom Barton from Gazette's Des Moines Bureau. Iowa to get $9 million to fight opioid crisis. The White House on Friday said the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services would receive $9 million in state opioid response money as part of the $1.5 billion it announced in nationwide funding to help combat the nation's opioid epidemic. A White House official said the grant funding is being distributed as soon as possible through the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, also known as SAMHSA, an arm of the Department of Health and Human Services, but no timeline has been set. The grants are to fight the devastating impact the overdose epidemic has had on this nation, including in large cities, small towns, tribal lands, and every community in between. "Addressing the opioid crisis in our state is a top priority for Iowa HHS," Iowa Department of Health and Human Services spokeswoman Sarah Ekstrand responded in an email. "These funds will ensure we continue to grow and build upon the programming, preventions, and services we have put in place." The funding would supplement current efforts started with previous federal grants and address emerging priorities across the state to respond to the opioid crisis, according to information provided by the White House. The Biden administration estimates 1,100 Iowans will receive treatment and or recovery support services during the 2 years of the grant funding, with an additional 11,000 people in the state receiving prevention and or harm reduction services. The White House said in its statement, the focus of this project is to increase community capacity for successful local response to the opioid and stimulant crises. Rod Courtney of CRUSH of Iowa, a Cedar Rapids-based not-for-profit that provides support, resources, education, and referral for individuals with substance use disorder, called Friday's White House announcement encouraging. In particular, a planned $104 million investment to expand prevention services for substance use disorder in rural communities. The federal funding also allows states to increase investments in overdose education, peer support specialists in emergency departments, and other strategies Courtney said can help save lives in hard-hit communities. Personally, I think that would be a game-changer, he said, of the funding to help create new sites to provide medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder in rural communities, saying it brings the cost of care down and accessibility up. CRUSH of Iowa opened a peer-led recovery community center in Cedar Rapids in June. The drop-in center uses a peer-centered approach that promotes recovery through support groups and services, advocacy, outreach, and treatment and resource referrals. Courtney said of the increased investment in peer support specialists and coaches, that's just a huge piece of it. For somebody that dedicated their life to fighting the opioid epidemic, it's hopeful. It's encouraging. I very much look forward to see what else comes out of this. Cedar Rapids-based Area Substance Abuse Council has participated in the state opioid response grant since 2019. ASAC provides substance use and gambling disorder prevention, treatment, and recovery programs in Lynn, Jackson, Jones, Clinton, Benton, Delaware, and Dubuque counties. ASAC Clinical Director Cassandra Collins said in a statement, "We will continue to do so, utilizing the funds that we will continue to receive in assisting us in the treatment of our patients. ASAC supports and is appreciative of any funding that assists in combating the opioid epidemic that our patients in Iowa are facing. We will continue to serve our patients to hopefully reduce opioid overdoses and support their recovery." From the Iowa Today page, Cedar Rapids man accused of sexual abuse and holding woman against her will. From Emily Anderson, Dateline Cedar Rapids. A Cedar Rapids man was arrested Friday on charges he held a female against her will and sexually assaulted her. Cedar Rapids police responded to 4610 Tama Street Southeast at 9:18 a.m. Friday. The female was there and reported that Nelson Jr. Brox, age 41, held her inside a nearby apartment against her will and sexually assaulted her. She also said a knife was displayed during the incident, according to a news release from the Cedar Rapids Police Department. She was taken to a hospital. Officers found Brox in the apartment and detained him. He also was taken to a hospital for an unrelated condition. Brox is facing charges of second-degree sexual abuse, assault with a dangerous weapon, and obstruction of emergency communications. He's being held in the Linn County Jail. The Gazette has included in its top stories a reprint from the Associated Press, QAnon follower from Des Moines convicted in capital riot trial. An Iowa man was convicted Friday of charges that he led a crowd of rioters in chasing a U.S. Capitol police officer up a staircase and accosting other officers guarding the Senate, one of the most harrowing scenes of the mob's attack that day. A federal jury in Washington deliberated for roughly 4 hours before convicting Douglas Jensen of felony charges that he obstructed Congress from certifying the Electoral College vote on January 6, 2021, and that he assaulted or interfered with police officers during the siege. Jensen was convicted on all counts, including a charge that he engaged in disorderly conduct inside the Capitol while carrying a folding knife in his pocket. During the trial's closing arguments, a prosecutor accused Jensen of weaponizing rioters by taking the lead in chasing Capitol Police Officer Eugene Goodman up a staircase. A reporter's video of the confrontation went viral. Jensen, a construction worker from Des Moines, was wearing a T-shirt with a large Q expressing his adherence to the QAnon conspiracy theory. One of the most memorable images from the January 6th attack captured Jensen with his arms extended as he confronted a line of police officers near the Senate chambers. "Go arrest the vice president," Jensen told one of the officers, according to prosecutors. QAnon has centered on the baseless belief that former President Donald Trump was secretly fighting a sainted-worshipping cabal of deep state enemies, prominent Democrats, and Hollywood elites. Jensen believed the conspiracy theory's apocalyptic prophecy that, quote, "the storm" was coming and would usher in mass arrests and executions of Trump's foes, including Vice President Mike Pence. After scaling the outer walls of the Capitol, Jensen climbed through a broken window to enter the building. Prosecutors said Jensen learned from a friend's text message that Pence was about to certify the election results. "That's all about to change," Jensen replied. Jensen didn't testify at his trial, which started Tuesday. Goodman was a key witness for the prosecution. Moving to the Insight page, the Gazette's editorial is, I'll just say it's a little bit light today, in my opinion, but you'll decide, of course. It is titled, "Events Are Plentiful in Eastern Iowa." For those who say there's nothing to do in our Eastern Iowa communities, they can look no further than last weekend as a rebuttal. There was barely a dull moment. There was the Brunos fundraiser for the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library. The first ever Blocktoberfest rocked downtown Cedar Rapids. The last Cedar Rapids Farmers Market of the season was held, along with the Crunch Berry Run to fund public art, although both were abbreviated by bad weather. Thunderstorms also forced the cancellation of Bruce Morchestra, which was to once again bring Orchestra Iowa to the lawn of Bruce Moore. And of course, there was the Nevada at Iowa night football game, which was transformed into a surreal festive marathon by repeated thunderstorm delays. Among the late-night Kinnick Stadium gatecrashers was a wedding party and at least one dog. It was a memorable night and morning for fans who stuck it out through the entire 7-hour saga. So yes, the weather didn't cooperate, but last weekend shows the diverse array of events that have grown in the region and offer residents many entertainment options. In particular, the success of events drawing people to downtown Cedar Rapids at night, including the August Market After Dark and concerts at the McGrath Amphitheater, show there's an appetite for evening events. They're a shot in the arm for a downtown district seeking to adapt to the new reality of fewer workers occupying downtown offices during the day. We support the full slate of events, and we hope to see an expanding list of evening events. Continued success in drawing people downtown can serve as a springboard for investments in entertainment venues that can bring residents downtown nightly, such as the First and First West Project. Core neighborhoods, including downtown, Kingston Village, New Bohemia, and the Czech Village, already offer great entertainment options, with new events and venues enhancing those neighborhoods' power to draw residents and visitors. There's much to do in our region. Fall brings another full slate of events, and the Gazette says we urge you to check them out. Now, the Gazette has also included a guest column from Senator Joe Bolcom, a Democrat from Iowa City, and it is on the Insight page, and we will read it in its entirety. Oppose GOP bid to back court. Since the Iowa Supreme Court recognized that equal protection under the law included the right to marry the person you love, regardless of sexual orientation, Iowa Republicans have pushed to make Iowa's judicial branch as partisan as the legislature and governor's office. They've introduced political campaigning for and against judges, restructured the way we pick judges to include more political appointments by the governor, and even changed how the Supreme Court of Iowa operates. Last term, Republicans got their way as the court overturned precedent to strip your right to an abortion. Historically, the Iowa Constitution has worked to keep partisan politics out of justice. Its framework established a nonpartisan panel of attorneys, judges, and appointed members to sift applicants down to the three best qualified candidates and let the governor appoint among them. It was an effective system that led to the Iowa Supreme Court doing great things, for example, banning racial bias as a basis for court orders and enshrining civil rights. Sadly, in each of the last three legislative sessions, Republicans have changed the rules to promote more and more politics in the justice system. Finally, after years of breaking down the barriers that have insulated our courts from direct political influence, this past year, the governor was able to present three right-wing activists to stack the committee that nominates judges to our highest courts. I'm proud to have joined my Senate Democratic colleagues who stood up and said no to the partisan power grab and reject the most political slate of members to the Judicial Nominating Commission I've seen in my 24 years in the Iowa Senate. The Republican Party and its fat cat benefactors have been working to stack the court for decades. After a series of victories for civil rights, they realized that nonpartisan judges would not reliably lead to conservative policies. Both at the state and national level, the Republican Party has decided that you don't deserve justice from courts. You deserve their radical remaking of American society. At a national level, with the help of Senator Chuck Grassley, that entailed blocking all judicial appointments until Republicans controlled the process. In Iowa, Republicans have simply only allowed ultra-conservatives to choose who may be judged, who be a judge. Recent editorials and opinion pieces criticizing both sides for this partisanship miss the mark. Senate Democrats have been able to control one thing in the wake of this partisan takeover of our courts: rejecting a slate of obviously partisan nominees to put the final piece of this plan into operation. You do nothing to defend an apolitical justice system by wagging your finger at Republicans while condemning Democrats for not rubber-stamping those very same activists. We have an increasingly radical MAGA governor appointing increasingly radical members to select increasingly radical jurists. I will not accept the fiction that a judicial philosophy is in any way distinguishable from political affiliation. She packed our courts with partisans, and now it's open season on our rights and freedoms, says State Senator Joe Bolcom, Democrat from Iowa City. The Gazette has also included one community letter, this one from Diane Duncan Goldsmith, she's also from Iowa City, and it's under a heading that says, "Vote No on Iowa Gun Amendment." A constitutional amendment is on the November 8th ballot. Republican legislatures believed this amendment was needed because Iowa is one of six states whose constitution did not contain language regarding the right to keep and bear arms, regardless of the fact that this right is already guaranteed under the U.S. Constitution's Second Amendment. However, making this a fundamental right and including the sentence, "Any and all restrictions of this right shall be subject to strict scrutiny," makes this amendment significantly different from the U.S. Constitution. Strict scrutiny is the most stringent form of judicial review used in cases involving fundamental rights, such as freedom of speech. The Supreme Court uses strict scrutiny only when it thinks a law infringes on a fundamental right. According to Iowans for Gun Safety, the three states with strict scrutiny constitutional wording, Alabama, Missouri, and Louisiana, have some of the highest rates of gun deaths. Experts at the Giffords Law Center, which grades state gun laws, have given Iowa's current gun legislation an F. Approving this amendment could make it nearly impossible to pass and enforce any future gun laws, such as universal background checks, needing a license to carry a gun in public, or firearm safety training, or could risk overturning what few gun laws we have. We know gun deaths are a public health issue. Iowans should not be fooled into putting the rights of a gun above the health, safety, and lives of Iowans, says Diane Duncan Goldsmith of Iowa City. I'd like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, September 24th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries, starting first with the other notices from Iowa City. Michael Frederick Camp, age 86, died Monday, September 19th. Arrangements are being handled through Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. And from Maquoketa, John Bronson, age 58, died this past Wednesday, September 21st. Carson Celebration of Life Center is handling those arrangements. Cleo Faye Brecht died September 20th in Cedar Rapids. Private services will be held at Tien Funeral Home, and burial will be in Mound Cemetery in Benton County, Iowa. Memorials may be directed to the family. Next, we have an obituary for Marlon Keith Rolina, R-O-H-L-E-N-A. Mr. Rolina was age 81 and lived for quite some time in Gresham, Oregon, but he passed away on October 24th. He was born in 1940 in Cedar Rapids, where he lived until the late 1960s, which is possibly the reason why they've shared the obituary here. All services were held in there's going to be a celebration of life in Oregon, and everything else about this service will be connected in Oregon, so I will not move forward. They do say that if you happen to want to donate or offer a contribution in his memory, you can do that to Parkinson's Resources of Oregon. From Iowa City, Lyndon Christ, age 78, died February 23rd, 2022, at the Bird House in Johnson County, the hospice home. A celebration of Lyndon Christ's life will be held tomorrow, Sunday, September 25th, from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Ned Ashton House, 820 Park Avenue in Iowa City, and they're going to allow people to share their own memories and experiences at 4 p.m. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made in his memory to St. Olaf College Music Program in Northfield, Minnesota, the Animal Welfare Friends in Monticello, or the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, or a charity of your choice. From Marion, Keith Boone Hartley, age 51, passed away September 21st from complications of leukemia. A memorial service will be held Tuesday, September 27th at 10:30 a.m. at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Marion. Visitation will be Monday, September 26th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom. They do offer a public thank you to the doctors and care team on 3JCP at the University of Iowa Hospital, and offer the opportunity to donate to a memorial fund that has been established in his name. We have another out-of-state resident, Mary Ann Hudecek, H-U-D-E-C-E-K, age 86, of Columbus, Indiana, who passed away September 21st after living in a nursing home in Indianapolis after a long illness. She was born May 29th of 1936 in Cresco, Iowa, the oldest of five children of the late Orvie and Helen DeWall. She and her husband John moved to Columbus in 1963. But some of you may remember her, and so that is why we've included that notice today. We also have a very brief notice for Lachi, L-A-C-H-H-I, Maya Bosnet, age 86, of Cedar Rapids, who died Friday, September 23rd, just yesterday, following a long struggle with cancer. And then it just says to see a full notice or to leave online condolences, go to www.teahenfuneralhome.com. That's T-E-A-H-E-N, funeralhome.com. Next, from Cedar Rapids, Mary Jane Brandes, B-R-A-N-D-E-S, who died on her 92nd birthday, September 22nd, at Methwick Community. Visitation will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home from 4 to 7 p.m. Tomorrow, September 25th, with a vigil service beginning at 4 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will take place Monday, September 25th, at 10 a.m. at St. Matthew Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. Private family interment will occur in Waverly at St. Mary's Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, the family asks for memorials to be directed to St. Matthew Catholic Church, Catherine McCauley Center, or Mercy Medical Center Foundation. And the family does issue a public thank you to the nurses and staff at the Woodlands Methwick community for their loving care. Continuing, we have a couple more obituaries. William Simon Jacobson of Cedar Rapids, age 88, died Wednesday, September 21st at Belle Plaine Specialty Care. There will be a funeral mass Monday, this coming Monday, September 26th, at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church. Burial will be at St. Anne Cemetery in Long Grove. Friends may visit with the family after 9 a.m. Monday at the church. Tea and Funeral Home is serving the family. Bill, from what I can read here, was a long-time teacher in the Cedar Rapids School District. He began teaching there in 1962 and retired from Kennedy High School in 1995. Instead of flowers, memorials may be directed to Birthright of Cedar Rapids, 375 Collins Road Northeast in Cedar Rapids. Our final obituary is for Janet Ann Wheeler of Keystone, age 71, who died from cancer on Thursday, September 22nd, at her family farm in Watkins. She had a long career in the State Department's Foreign Service, stationed in 10 different countries. The family issues a statement thanking Dr. Bell and Unity Point Hospice team for their support, guidance, and comfort during a difficult time. On November 25th, a joint celebration of life will be held for Janet and her sister Diane, who passed away 5 weeks prior. The celebration will be held at the Blairstown Community Center in Blairstown from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Well, we will move on to prep sports now, and you'll sense a theme that every story I'm going to cover here is about football, and that's because there's nothing else prep-wise in the Gazette today. So everything is about football. I can't even tell you if there were any other athletic events to cover. So we will cover that football, and I may end up having to shorten them a little bit for the interest of time. In Class 5A, from K.J. Pilcher, this article titled, A Full-On Booting, City High Routes West in Battle for the Boot, 49-0. K.J. writes, first, Iowa City High handed out the kicking, then the Little Hawks took the boot. They left little doubt where the traveling trophy was heading. Quarterback Drew Larson scored as a passer, rusher, and receiver, contributing to 6 total touchdowns, and the Little Hawks dominated crosstown rival Iowa City West 49-0 in the battle for the boot last night at West Trojan Field. City High coach Mitch Moore said, "We talk about confidence and preparation, and we were really confident in our preparation. We came out here and played our style of football. This was the first time we played similar to how we did last year, with energy, passion, and great communication." Larson finished with 293 total yards, including 250 and 4 scores through the air. He added a 1-yard quarterback sneak for a score and reeled in a 15-yard TD pass from Oliver Niss. Larson said, "I loved it. I love being on the field at all times, helping my team in any way I can." The Little Hawks, with a record of 2-2, blitzed West early, scoring on their first 4 possessions of the game for a 28-0 lead in the first 14 minutes and 24 seconds of the game. Ben Cooter, K-U-E-T-E-R, rushed for 44 of his 134 yards on the first drive and capped it with a 12-yard TD pass to Carson Newton. Larson said about the opening drive score, "It's huge. It's always the biggest thing for us, starting off with that touchdown and things start rolling from there." End quote. Larson went to work, flinging a sidearm pass to Connor Cross, cutting through the middle for a 34-yard TD, and then scoring on a reception to cap a 9-play, 82-yard drive for a 3-touchdown lead before the end of the first. City High capitalized on a turnover and good field position right before the half, returning a fumble to the West 45 with 50 seconds left. Larson rolled to his right and hit Akili Maddox on 4th and 14 for a 37-yard TD pass. Newton and Maddox scored on TD passes of 27 and 13 yards, respectively, in the second half. Newton finished with 86 yards on 7 catches, and Maddox had 66 on 5. Ronnie Major had 150 total yards with 79 receiving. City High recorded its second straight 49-point victory over West and improved to 3-2 this season. The Little Hawks snapped West's 3-game win streak. They celebrated with fans and hoisted the long-standing trophy again, Cooter said, "It's a huge deal. It's on the east side where it belongs, especially in a dominant fashion. It was great. It was exciting." And of course, there are several pictures of the Little Hawks celebrating after that win and some of the game day, you know, pictures. City High quarterback Drew Larson scores a touchdown. And so lots of pictures and victory celebrations. Jeff Linder supplies this story from Class 4A, Schulte's 200th victory at Xavier, a rout of Washington. Duane Schulte allowed his mind to wander through the misty final minutes at Kingston Stadium. He said, "I was kind of thinking about all the former players we've had. They all helped us get to this point, and I'm happy for the current guys that can say they were here for this moment. It's not my win, it's Xavier's win. Xavier's win, Schulte's win. For the last 25 years, they've been one and the same. 200 and the same, actually." Class 4A, third-ranked Cedar Rapids Xavier whipped Cedar Rapids Washington on both sides of the ball in a 38-0 Class 4A District 4 football rout last night. For Xavier and for Schulte, it is the 200th victory in the program's 25th year. 200 wins and 70 losses, to be exact. That's an average of 8 wins a year. That's a quarter century of consistent excellence. "It starts with the players," said Schulte, whose career mark is 225 wins and 84 losses. He coached at Cedar Rapids LaSalle before becoming Xavier's first head coach in 1998. You've got to have players willing to do what you ask them to do, and families that support them, and assistant coaches. Football is a sport where you have to have great assistant coaches. I know it's a cliche, but the guys did their jobs tonight, and did them extremely well. Xavier, at 5-0 overall, 1-0 in the district, outgained Washington with a record of 2-3, 0-1 in the district, by a margin of 315 yards to 42, and the Warriors were below 0 yards against Xavier's first-string defense. The first 8 possessions would succinctly be explained as thus: Washington 3 and out, punt, Xavier touchdown, Washington 3 and out, punt, Xavier touchdown, Washington 3 and out, punt, Xavier touchdown, Washington 3 and out, punt, and so on. Quarterback Ronan Thomas capped the Saints' first drive with a 1-yard scoring sneak, then Michael Cunningham did the honors on the next 3 scoring drives. Cunningham got loose for a 28-yard TD run off tackle, then rambled for a 37-yard score. His third touchdown came on a 4th-and-3 from the 10. Cunningham said the O-line did a great job. "They opened some huge holes on those touchdown runs. I was untouched." Xavier's 5th touchdown of the half came on Thomas's 12-yard scoring strike to Grant Helm, and the Saints took a 35-0 lead into the locker room. They also have a roundup, little brief stories. Henson powers West Branch to win, from Jason Miller. Andy Henson rushed for 163 and 4 touchdowns as 5th-ranked West Branch dominated number 10 Minneapolis 35-13. Minneapolis Anthony Isley scored on the opening kickoff, but the Bears scored 35 unanswered points. Quarterback Ty Hughes added 233 total yards and a passing TD. Minneapolis totaled just 74 yards, 80 on their final drive. West Branch travels to Durant next week for another battle of undefeated teams. We have Cedar Rapids Prairie 49, Ottumwa 14. Early struggles turned into a comfortable victory as the host Hawks completed a happy homecoming. After falling behind 7-0, Prairie scored on its next 7 possessions, a 75-yard kickoff return from Casey Kelly and a 14-yard touchdown run from Mikael Taylor evened the score at 14. Taylor finished with 4 touchdowns, 2 rushing and 2 receiving, as Prairie outgained Ottumwa 365 to 247 yards. That summary was from Cully Klein. I'll just read you a few other scores. Lynn Marr beat Cedar Rapids Jefferson 56-6. Cedar Rapids Kennedy was shut out Dubuque Senior 38-0. Western Dubuque really dominated Marion 42-7. And Monticello 42 shut out West Liberty. Independence 46, South Tama 6, Turkey Valley 61, Janesville 8. So boy, I'll tell you what, it was not a night of close games. From the business section, we have a nice in-depth article titled Study Sees Barriers and Solutions to Startup. This is Isabella Zalewski's article, Dateline Iowa City. Affordable spaces, mentorship programs, and community areas are among the recommendations that would help further support minority business owners in Johnson County. The Inclusive Economic Development Plan, led by ASDIC Planning, a community and environmental planning business in Iowa City, has been in the works for about a year, conducting research, surveys, focus groups, and interviews. The plan identifies barriers and potential solutions for business owners in Johnson County who have been historically underrepresented. V. Fixmer-Aries, founder and CEO of ASDIC Planning, presented the plan's findings to the Iowa City Council this week, saying what's really great is that there is a lot of momentum and interest, and particularly with American Rescue Plan Act funding. We are hopeful that this plan can show there's internal work that needs to be done, and there's also a lot of barriers that need to be removed. The Iowa City Council, in process of allocating its pandemic relief dollars, intends to use the study to help guide funding decisions to support BIPOC person business owners. The city tentatively has allocated $4 to $6 million for possible initiatives. City staff will work to develop targeted proposals, according to a city memo. Mayor Pro Tem Megan Alter said at Tuesday's council meeting, "This is a phenomenal and really thorough dive into this that just peels back layers and layers. I think we're going to be in a much better position to move forward because of this work." The draft plan found rent cost, gaps in resource information, missing relationships with business support systems, and finding a location are among the barriers business owners face. Another barrier is individuals feel intimidated going into a bank or where the documents or information are inaccessible. Fixmer-Aries said, "We're also talking about financial literacy. We're talking about all these kinds of things that really buy into actual financial resources," end quote. The study found that there aren't many programs in Johnson County that specifically focus on serving underserved business owners. The programs that do exist are still emerging. Another barrier is that a majority of materials about lending or support programs are only available in English. The study found only 17% of institutions provide information in a different language, oftentimes Spanish. Fixmer-Aries said, "It's not that you just want to have a document translated in another language. You need to have that follow-up person that can help. We're not just talking about a one-and-done. We're really talking about a dynamic interaction." The plan has 5 recommended action items, each with its own set of suggested changes or improvements. 3 action items are for internal changes: changes in policies and procedures at multiple levels, internal work for local governments and business support institutions, and bolster entities that currently are supporting small businesses. 2 action items involve public-facing support, that are provide resources to the underestimated entrepreneurial and business community, and build infrastructure to create spaces for underestimated businesses to thrive. It would be an opportunity for an emerging business owner to hear from someone who has navigated the financial landscape, legal terms, and experienced the same barriers. Other potential solutions identified include affordable spaces, grant opportunities, translated documents, community networking, and accelerator programs. Fixmer-Aries said among the next steps includes presenting findings to other local governments in the county and returning to see where the recommendations fit with funding priorities, saying nobody wants a plan to sit on a shelf, and this plan is too important. ASDIC Planning wanted to get a clearer picture of barriers and resources for underestimated community members who own or are interested in starting a business in the county. Underestimated community members include Black, Latino, Asian American, immigrants, and formerly incarcerated individuals among those who have been historically underrepresented. The effort has been led by ASDIC Planning with help from Green State Credit Union, Iowa City Area Development Group, Iowa City Area Business Partnership, and the Multicultural Development Center of Iowa, among other groups. A total of 105 individuals responded to the survey. From those, 63 are existing business owners, 17 are emerging business owners, and 24 support institutions for businesses. There are 25 different races identified and 29 ethnicities identified among the respondents. From the living section, there is this article from Diana Nolan, Dateline Cedar Rapids, and the title is Help on the Hoof, subtitled Goats Clearing the Way for Restoration Planting in Bruce Moore's Timber. Bruce Moore's newest workforce was seen lying down on the job Tuesday afternoon, which was understandable since the temperature outdoors climbed into the mid-90s that day. The crew was livelier Thursday morning. These workers labor only outdoors and pretty much whenever they feel like it. Sports teams have their GOATs, G-O-A-T, as in greatest of all time, an honorific most recently bestowed upon retired tennis star Serena Williams. But the hungry, hired hoofs at Bruce Moore are goats every day, performing an essential landscaping service. They are on hand to clear weeds and underbrush from the timber along Linden Drive, following the curve to Crescent Street Southeast, preparing the land for restoration planting. That area was especially hard hit by the August 2020 derecho, which throughout the 26-acre historic estate destroyed 450 major trees, representing about 75% of the canopy, said David Jansen, Bruce Moore's executive director. He continued, to our knowledge, no other cultural landscape in U.S. history has lost more in one day than Bruce Moore did on August 10, 2020. We're still losing trees to the storm, so it's an exciting opportunity to be the greatest comeback in U.S. history. And 45 goats from Goats on the Go Dubuque are blazing the trail. They come from Cox Springs Farm in rural Piasta, west of Dubuque, and will be at Bruce Moore at least another week. We have about 2 acres of woodland that need to be grazed, and a herd of goats continuously graze 1 acre in about a week, said Brett Seelman of Seelman Landscape Architecture in Cedar Rapids, heading up the historic estate's landscape restoration. He also is covering the goat rental fee, which ranges between $1,000 to $1,500 a week. Seelman said, I said I'll donate this because it's that important. It's important to really take this approach as we're going through restoring the estate. This is really the most ecological and economical way to restore and to manage and conserve the property. The estate's gates are open from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday and 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Saturday and Sunday, so visitors walking or driving through the grounds can see the goats at work or rest. But the animals are penned inside electric fencing set back from the locked 7-foot deer fencing, so don't expect any close encounters with the foragers. The goats are far enough back that if you're walking through, you cannot reach over and pet them. Jansen said there are enough of them that you'll see them in the timber, but there will be no goat yoga. It's not a petting zoo. They're there to do a job, so we want to stay out of their way and make them work. Seelman added, they're very entertaining. It's been incredible to watch how much joy they've brought, and it's a goat, but they bring a lot of joy, and they're doing a lot of work for us. Seeing them lying down on the job was sweet, too, on Tuesday when they just weren't so hungry. Seelman said, it's very similar to people who do tend to eat less when the temperature is hot. So the fact that we had this 94-degree day, they didn't eat as much, and they can only eat a certain percentage of their body weight, so you are going to see them taking a few breaks throughout the day. Why goats? Because elephants are too expensive, Jansen quipped. Turning serious, he noted, fundamentally, we are recovering from the derecho, which is a long process. We're going to put upward of 300 to 400 trees in that timber in October, and we needed to clear the invasives that were really thriving with all the sunlight we're getting. He added, goats and livestock in general for grazing is a best practice. One of the things we're working with Bruce Moore is they've been very receptive. An initiative of our restoration efforts is that we do best practices as we're going through the state. As David said, post-derecho, we have so many invasives that have just taken over the ground plants of our properties and our woodlands. At Bruce more specifically, honeysuckle, multiflora, rose, black locust, garlic mustard, oriental bittersweet. These are all invasive plants thriving in the amount of sun that the woodland gets right now. And fortunately, they're some of the goat's favorite food. Employing goats as groundskeepers may sound novel, but it's nothing new. Seelman said it really is a practice that's been around for hundreds of years. We knew they would snap up these invasive. They'd go places where people can't get or other larger animals can't go, and they're light-footed, so they work in terrain and aerate the ground plane softly. It allows us to reduce the amount of machinery we have on the property and in the woodland, preserving the trees that you do have still standing, and it also really helps us reduce the use of harmful chemicals. And finally, Seelman said, "For me, the greatest satisfaction will be seeing this landscape really change and evolve over time. There's a lot of youth on the Bruce Moore staff and on our team, and I think having this group work hard toward the next 20, 30, 50 years of restoration will be very rewarding."